welcome to Script Lock, where we talk about storytelling and video games. I'm Nick Folkman.
And I'm Max Folkman. Today's episode has Mel McCoubry and Anne LeMay joining us. Mel is a writer and director of narrative design at Ubisoft Quebec, and has worked on such games as Far Cry 4, Assassin's Creed Freedom Cry, and Assassin's Creed Syndicate. Anne is a writer and narrative designer who has worked on titles including Mass Effect 3, Dragon Age Inquisition, and Mass Effect Andromeda. She is a co-writer of the book The Game Narrative Toolbox, and has recently announced that she has left BioWare for a new mysterious gig elsewhere. Thanks for coming on the show, you two.
Hi.
So we'll start with how you two broke into the industry. Mel, can you please go first?
Sure. So I always wanted to be in games. And I had an interview for my high school because I went to a private school. And they asked me in that interview, like, what do you want to do when you grow up? And I said, I want to work in video games because I loved games a lot. And they were like, oh, you can't do that. You have to go to university. So I was like, oh, man, adults, they're right. So I went to university. And in university, I got really into I was going for acting, and I kind of faded out of that and went into writing. And in my third year, I got a 70% on a first-year poetry exam. And I went to my playwriting teacher, and I was like, what do I do with my life? I'll never make it anywhere with these kinds of marks. And he was like, well, what do you want to do? And I was like, video games. And he's like, oh, hey, I know somebody at Ubisoft Montreal. Like, why don't I get you in touch? And that was super cool. His name is Matt Turner, and he now works in Vancouver. And he gave me a little tour, and then when I was on that tour, I was like, here's a giant binder of everything I've ever done. And then a couple weeks later, he was like, oh, there's an internship position open, what do you think? And eventually had the interview, and then the day of the interview, they were like, hey, can you start in 3 weeks? And I said, yes.
What was in that binder?
Lots of artwork, like really scary artwork. I was always like really into scary stuff. There was a couple of different kinds of plays. There was some short stories that I had done in university, you know, like general writer's portfolio, but then also like a lot of artwork.
Was your teacher right? Do you have to go to university to be in video games?
I think there's something about university that they don't really tell you about, is that like regardless of whether or not you get a degree, there's like a social learning. And I think like I obviously wouldn't know that connection if I didn't go to university. So they were right in that aspect. But I know there are lots of people who don't have degrees, and I think that's perfectly fine. So I think what they meant when they said book learning is probably not always accurate. What do you think, Anne?
Yes and no. You don't need to, because of the way how I got into video games specifically showed that you don't, but it can be harder depending on the discipline. Programming, you definitely want more studies. Level design, I've seen people come straight out of just having done their own levels without any really serious university education. Like Mel was saying, though, the seasoning that it gives you as a person with your social interactions and learning to hand in papers is invaluable, though, for games, especially since we document stuff. We need to know how to document our stuff and so on and so forth. We need to know how to interact with other disciplines, and that's pretty vital.
Yeah. As long as we're talking about how you got into the industry, can you just go into that now? Then I'll ask my second Mel question after.
Sure. I got into games in a very, you know, non-traditional, unusual, will probably not ever happen again way. In 1997, Ubisoft established itself in Montreal, and they basically set out to train their own workforce. And that's when I got into games. I got hired without any experience. And I got hired because of my university degree in art history, actually, for one of the very, very early how to draw programs that they had as a community manager. Huh. And from there, I moved into, okay, I need to remember this. It was a long route. I moved from there, community manager, to graphic designer for the websites, to redoing the menus of a game on overtime in 80 hours in 2 weeks.
Wow.
Which You're a led powerhouse. Me in,
yeah, which led me into interface design. So I did that for a while. Then I left the industry for a year. went into telecom, where of all things, I learned how to wireframe and how to do structures and navigation, which is super useful. Came back for 1 month as level designer on a project, and then seeked into writing. No, game design and then writing. There you go.
Were you writing before all this?
Yes, yes. I'd been writing for a long time. Honestly, even all that time I was in games before I became a game writer, I never would have thought I would become a writer.
Why is
that?
It just
wasn't something I ever thought I would make money at. My mother always thought I would become a painter, an artist.
You definitely make money doing that.
Yeah. I do okay now. it was like, it just happened really fast. I was on a project. We'd been brought back at Ubisoft. There's a lot of back and forth in all this time. And someone just gave me a shot. Like, I knew the producer at the time. They were doing a presentation for Greenlight, and I went over their documents and I was like, no, you guys need to have an English pass on this to smart, you know, tighten it up a bit. And just from having that ease to just be able to go to the producer and say, I'll do a pass for you. The creative director saw how I handled it and said, we want another writer for the English passes on the script. And because it's a Francophone company, so like they wanted to be sure that the English was okay, which is hilarious because I'm Francophone speaking. I just learned English when I was very young. And I got a shot that way and I just never looked back. I stayed in writing and I love it.
And with your experience like wireframing, do you think writers should know that, or like programming in general, to work in industry? And like, Mel, do you, as like a narrative director, do you look for writers with that additional experience?
I think writers are neglected a lot of the times, the experience, like, or the training to learn these kinds of things. So not necessarily, like, a lot of writers come in as writers and they want to be writers and that's fine. But I think there's like a certain degree of wanting to learn and needing to learn how other aspects of making a game happens. And so a lot of the times, though, they get looked at as like, well, you're a writer, so just write. You don't need to know any of the rest of this stuff, when I think it really helps if they do.
What do you think, Anne?
Yeah, no, I totally agree with Mel. And again, my experience, I have a bias towards that, but I was a game designer before I was a writer. The wireframing, which is just how to navigate through menus, I use that now with my level designers. When I present a conversation or a mission to them, they get a Visio structure. They don't get a Word document. I can speak other disciplines' language in terms of presentation.
And it's so important. And like someone once told me, like, the reason you've done so well is because you can think in terms of flow charts. And I think it's something that really benefits writers if they can do that.
Yep. And also just understanding how programming works at a very basic level lets you at least reach out to other disciplines and go, hey, I know we can't do this, but what if we try this way? It creates an openness where people will go, oh, well, you're not asking me something crazy because you have an understanding of what our limitations and what we can do and can't do. And then they tend to want to do more with you as a result.
Does that knowledge ever pose a problem? Like, would it be a problem, and would it rein in your creativity in some way?
Would you be scared of coming up with something where you know how much work it would take to implement?
Yeah.
No, because then understanding how each discipline works is what helps you to figure out how to do what you want.
And also how to sell it to the other teams.
Yeah.
So if you're like, oh, I want to do this stuff, here's how it's going to work, they're going to say, oh, yeah, I know how that flowchart goes. Let's do that thing. On the flip side, you're like, here's a paragraph about what I would like to do. People are like, oh, reading, it sucks.
Yeah, you want to create things with people, not just dump things on their desks and walk away. So, like, if you're working with someone, you can get them engaged and involved and interested in what you're doing. That's really important. That's a really, really, especially narrative, that's such an important skill.
Yeah.
And Mel, you just mentioned, like, selling things to people. How important is being a salesperson to other departments?
It's super important. I feel like, one, narrative can sometimes be undervalued. So if you can sell it well, then it is something that you will be able to do. But it's also, like, it's one of the things that I've learned over the course of doing this job and the assistant director job, that communication is huge, because a lot of things end up if you have poor communication, you have way more email fights than you do actually have stuff to work on. So if you can communicate with the other teams, you can both get what you want and give what they need, and ultimately make a better game.
Is that the same for you, Anne?
Absolutely. I mean, it's writing for video games is not like writing a short story or a novel.
No.
As much as some people like to try to work that way, you're not an island. You are working in a committee. You're working with a team. You're one cog of a machine. And sometimes you're a starting point. Most of the time you're not. So you've got to learn to work with all the other disciplines and people in order to get stuff done. Yeah. I mean, if you haven't talked with your cinematics guy, your cinematics person's just going to do whatever they want with your scene. So,
Mel, you said writing was undervalued. Do you mean undervalued in the studio?
I think undervalued as a whole, because everybody thinks they can write, whether or not they can, because everybody
the most
has,
common note.
Yeah, I know. Everybody can put a pen on a piece of paper. Well, lots of people can put a pen on a piece of paper and write a letter, or they've written an email, or they've written a text message, and therefore they think they can write. So a lot of the time, writers are kind of thought of as like the easy job. And it's really not the easy job. So I think they're undervalued in that sense.
And that problem is kind of exacerbated by Twitter, where like people get like the one funny tweet off and like, man, this is great. I can do this all the time. But anyone can write, but can you write consistently well?
That's under pressure.
What?
Under pressure.
Yeah. That's what can determine if you can actually do this as a job.
Mm-hmm. That's the biggest thing about being a professional writer, is that inspiration and muses or whatever, just forget all about that. You have a word count and you start writing when you get at work, and you got to get done when people need your scenes.
Yeah, probably before that, actually.
All right, so I'm going to ask about your internship, Mel. But first, okay, Let's get into writing processes, because it's a good segue into that. So, Anne, what is your writing process like?
Open a file, freak out for a good 10 minutes if I don't know what I'm doing yet, if I just come to a scene cold, and then just start writing lines if I have to write it in Valley speak, or if I just, you know, if I write it in the silliest way possible, but you just got to get stuff down. Mm-hmm. And then you just go over it and you clean it up and you make it into a more serious scene or whatever it needs to be. And then sometimes I know exactly what I want to do and it's the best thing ever. And then sometimes exactly what I wanted to do is crap and I got to throw it out and do it again. But yeah, it's I don't want to say the daily grind, but it's your daily routine. You sit down, you go through your stuff, and when you're in the writing phase of a project, you just open your files and you start writing.
Does it take you a while to get into the rhythm of writing?
Yeah, it really depends. Sometimes it'll happen right away, and sometimes I'll spend a whole day just staring at the screen, hating my life. What really helps, though, is when you're working with a team. That can really help you get things back in gear, is just to lean back and poke a fellow writer, or even just someone on the team that you're used to talking ideas out with, if you're the sole writer on a project, and just throwing ideas at them and getting a quick brainstorm through. When I worked alone, it was much more a question of discipline, of structuring out my scenes and just getting the writing done, because you don't have the leisure to spend time just wondering what to write.
Yeah.
And when you have a team, which is the best thing ever, you can really just go, I don't know what to do, this, and you get three ideas thrown at you by people, and then you just pick one and run.
Totally understand that. Writing partners are great.
Mm-hmm.
What's your writing process like, Mel?
My writing process is, okay, this is assuming that I've always written with a team. I mean, I've done personal writing projects, but not for games. So this is assuming that we've figured out what the design is already. To me, it's always just do it, because it's one, like Anne said, it's your job. I believe in writer's block, but I've never had it, knocking on wood right now. I've had artist block, like I know what that is too. But because, especially now, because I'm in a position that's so much busier than just having to do the writing part, and the writing part is so huge, I'm not belittling that, but because there's more to it than that, and I'm so busy in the office, a lot of the times I like to go home, and once we figured out the design, of course, like, go home and do the writing alone, which I didn't always have to do that, but now I kind of have to. As to like the planning process, my head does most of the work for me because I'm like obsessively thinking about what it is I have to work on. So my brain kind of helps me process like, oh, this would be a really great way to do that scene, like in the shower or something. And then I just sit down and do it.
And do you write at home after work too?
It depends on the state, the phase of the project. If we're in heavy writing on the project, and especially if we're doing more time, I just don't bother writing at home. I need the downtime. I need to let my brain rest. If it's light phases of writing, or even if we're just not doing writing yet because we're in, pre-production or stuff like that, then yes, I will tend to write at home.
Mel, so with your internship, what did that actually entail?
So I was an intern for the Alice Studio in Montreal that deals with hiring talent, and which meant that I worked under both the talent director, Chris Brown at the time, and Corey May, who was like head of all of the narrative at the studio. And so I was working on scripts with him. I would read scripts that he would also read, and I would make comments on them, and then we would sit together and talk about our comments on the scripts that we were reading. He would compile the notes, and then we'd talk face to face with the writer that wrote the script to relay the feedback. He did most of the talking at that point, but it was a really, really neat process for me to be in on. And then whenever any of the teams needed help doing things like editing tutorial text and writing menu like items, then I would also help them with that.
And these were teams from different games, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Does Ubisoft still do this internship program?
Not in the same way, I don't think. They have been hiring interns recently, but they are for specific projects instead of the studio as a whole. Like, I feel like I was really lucky that I kind of got to explore all the different kinds of games that were happening at the time and doing different things for them and meeting all of the different writers and having to work with people in different departments on different teams. So I've always quite admired that internship program that they had. And that's not to say that what they have now on the specific teams isn't good. I mean, obviously the writers that are being hired for internship positions are really getting a taste of what it's like to build a game because they're on one specific team. They work with a team of writers, and they really get a feel for what's going on the production floor, where I was kind of removed from that sometimes because even if I was working on the games, I'd still be doing it somewhere else, and I would just occasionally visit. So I'm sure what they're doing is also great. Like, I have interns that work for me in the same capacity, but I've always liked that idea of having an internship that's kind of overlooking the entire studio and everybody's different processes.
Yeah, it sounds awesome. For both of you, what do you stress about most when you're writing?
Obviously, am I writing crap or not? Is everyone going to hate this, you know, the habitual existential angst of a writer? Length is a big thing, in especially for video game writing. You don't want to write lines that are too long. Most games you'll have to keep shortening. So first pass is just getting the ideas out. But as you iterate over it, keeping dialogue snappy, not repeating yourself, making sure that what the scene or the even just what the banter needs to convey is there.
Is your worry about length because of voice acting and the cost of that?
Localization, translation, voice acting, and also just, I mean, if the scenes go on and on, you don't want to risk losing player interest either. You don't want to have, you know, heavy exposition scenes. You want to have snappy scenes that, you know, are interesting, convey information without lasting too long.
Yeah, we kind of say at my studio, we don't want to make reading the video game.
Mm-hmm. What do you stress out about, Mel?
After hearing Anne's answer, I feel kind of like a freak, but I also worry about those things, but kind of to a lesser extent, because I'm like, okay, Mel, like, you can do this. You can do the writing. That's what you were hired for. I worry about not doing enough stuff, like, or getting enough of the writing done fast enough. And I do it fairly quickly, but I'm always worried that I'm not doing enough because there's so much more to do.
I have that problem.
See, oh, yeah? I used to worry about that, and then I worked on a Bioware game, and I got over that really fast.
Okay, well, I'm glad that I'll grow out of it.
Because there's just so much writing to do, you cannot even try to look at it, or else you'll just freeze and keel over. So it's like, don't look at all the writing, just do what's in front of you right now.
So how do you do all that Bioware writing? Like, do you just compartmentalize it?
Oh, well, I mean, we're a team, which is a good thing. We have a lot of writers. And we just share it out and we go at it. And we know that if you're there to pick up on someone, if they need help, and someone's there to help you out too, if you need it. With that much writing, having a team is a godsend. It's the best thing in the world.
How many writers are we talking about generally?
7 to 11 writers, depending on the phase and on the game itself and what the scope is intended.
And are you all working out of one area? Like, do you meet in a room and then split off during the day, or how does that work?
Depending on the studios, the layouts are different. BioWare has writing rooms for their writers in Edmonton. Montreal is an open floor structure, but basically we're in this geographically we're in the same place for the bulk of the writing. But sometimes too, they'll split us up in teams with our level designers and other people and senior designers to create pods. So layout really depends, but usually for the start of the project, at least we're all together, and that lets us brainstorm and work together.
This is switching gears for a bit, but has what you respond to / are looking for in a game narrative changed over the years? And what do you look for now? And what stories do you want to play?
So for games in general, like not just like exclusively narrative, it's always been how inclusive games are and how much more inclusive they need to be. And the longer I'm in the industry, the more I expect of myself to deliver on this and other people to deliver on this. Probably started because when I got my first game console, it wasn't a console, it was a handheld. It was the Game Boy, and my dad called it a Game Girl just for me, even though I associated like girls and games as a negative relationship for a while for some reason. But for game narrative, for like narrative in games, I look forward to sending messages. This is going to sound corny, but like sending messages of hope to players. Like, I want to send good messages to players. Like, there's a lot of bad stuff that happens in the world a lot, and I think games are a form of escapism. And as much as I like games being a challenge, I also want games to be a comfort for people.
Yeah, it's not corny at all. I'm 100% on board with that.
Thank you.
I want someone to feel good after playing the game.
Exactly.
For my part, like 100% with Mel has said, obviously, and diversity is a huge deal for me. But I'll be really honest, as I've gotten old and curmudgeon-y about my stuff, I just want to play female characters. It's like, that's one of the first barriers for me in any game these days is, can I play a female character?
Oh my gosh, nope. Me too.
Is this game really diverse and doing something awesome, though I can't play a female character? That might get it a buy, but otherwise, I'm just like, that'll be my stopper right there. If I can't play a female character, I'm like, did my friends work on it?
I know, okay.
I don't know.
I've just had this feeling not that long ago. Like, I have this feeling a lot, but I just had, like, a very significant moment for myself, if I'm allowed to jump in on this. I'm not sure if I can say this on the podcast, but you can decide. I recently bought Civ 6, and I was really excited because I love Civ 5. And there, out of the 20 options of leaders to play, there were only 4 women. And I know, like, 4 is better than none, but I was still like, oh, man, there's so many women. There's, like a handful more women in Civ 5. Like, why is there only 4 options? And I felt really disappointed, and I wanted to refund the game and, like, get it later when the DLCs came out.
Did you?
No, because I don't know how to do it on Steam.
Hope for DLC women.
That's what I'm gonna do. Like, hopefully I didn't just like spend that lot of money for nothing, because I haven't played it since my first playthrough, because I was just really disheartened. So I feel you on that front, Anne.
Mm-hmm.
I'll keep that. It's not a problem. Oh yeah, I missed talking about this. Mel, what does being a narrative director entail?
The first thing that comes to mind is having like your fingers in all of the pies. The one thing that people don't really know in other departments is that narrative is everywhere. Like, it doesn't just stop at writing.
Mm-hmm.
And so, like, a lot of my job is going in between different departments, being the go-between between, like, the narrative vision and the narrative team and everybody else. You're also the wall that people hit before they get to the writers. I also kind of think of this, like, I don't know if it was his joke because he was criticized for stealing jokes, but Dane Cook had a joke about the movie theater and how when you get to the movie late, or if you enter the theater and the movie is just starting, that the first like 10 minutes of the movie are always in like darkness. There's never like a 10-second flashback to a beach. And so you kind of have to evolve into like a greater being to find where your seat is. And I kind of feel like when you're in this position and you have to talk to so many people and you have to see everything that's coming and you have to kind of assess needs as they come through you and deliver needs to other teams, that you kind of have to like open your eyes super wide and evolve into a greater being so that you can catch all of it.
Do you have to learn those kind of new skills on every project, or have you gotten better about it since you've become narrative director?
I think every project definitely is a very different scenario, but I think that aspect of narrative being everywhere is something that is consistent throughout all games that people kind of need to be taught on each one.
This is a question for both of you. Is there one thing that you wish all departments knew about narrative to start with?
That we can help make things better.
Yeah.
That, like, seriously, like, having worked at BioWare for 5 years was such a wonderful experience, because every single level designer was eager and thrilled to be working with their writer on their level. We would just, like, with my level designers, we would just sit down and walk through the level step by step together, play through it and go, hey, we can put a thing here. Or, and then I would go, I did this thing in another mission. We could put a reference to it here. You know, I'm not talking data pads or narrative. I'm talking like visual artifacts that just do callbacks and tell a more complete story. And then that's the cooperation that, as Mel was saying, gives more depth to the entire narrative. And that's not just words or dialogue.
Mm-hmm. I agree with you on that.
Sounds too good to be true. I wish BioWare could just parachute into other studios and teach them this.
So, you know, like some level designers, just they don't know to approach writers and work with them because that's how they're taught. But I really do firmly believe as level designers acquire more experience, they, you know, and work with writers who know to reach out to them, this is the thing that happens regardless of the company. Like, I've had that experience at Ubisoft. I've had that experience elsewhere too. Just BioWare was kind of overwhelmingly consistent for that, which is amazing.
So is BioWare that good about it because of like leadership mandating that, or because like everyone knows the games they make and they assume that writers should be involved?
I think it's company culture. Like the day I walked in there was no one telling level design to reach out to us. The level designers themselves were like, hey, let's work on this together. So I think it's very much part of the process from day one, and it's something any new person coming in is trained into.
Okay. And Mel, was your answer to that writers can help?
Yeah, for sure. I'm with Anne on this one. I mean, I'm with Anne on all of them, but I'm with Anne on this one, too.
I mean, it's not just that, too. It's give and take, right? If a level designer has a huge thorny problem because of something I wrote, then, until my stuff has gone to localization and voice acting, I can change it to help them. And it's super important that, you know, other disciplines know this, because sometimes, yeah, unfortunately, writing can change the easiest as long as it's not like impact on the main narrative. If it's a side mission, I can nuke it. It just need, you know, I need to up, you know, talk to my managers and stuff like that. But it's a cooperative process, not just among writers, but among the entire team.
I want to backtrack to when, Ann, you were talking about trying to keep writing concise and short. For both of you, how do you write for the players who don't care about story, just want to get into gameplay as fast as possible?
When it depends on the genre, there are certain kinds of games that you know the writer, like the player will come at it and not care about the writing. And that's when you just don't do much writing, and you do environmental narrative, and you try to pass your story in a way that will have impact, but isn't necessarily just about dialogue or scenes. And if you're going to be working on a game like an RPG, like Mass Effect, or stuff like Assassin's Creed, you know it's part of the package. You know there's more narrative to that. And it's just a question of we're working for our audience.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. It's interesting because I don't really love playing like huge, like heavily written games a lot of the time. There's something to me that's just like, I just want to get into it and figure it out for myself. And this is why I love games like Civ or The Sims or something like Animal Crossing or something, because it's like the narrative you are creating as you're making decisions in a game. And it means more to me because it's obviously in my head instead of someone being like, you need to feel this way, you need to feel that way. I'm not saying that stories don't work. They totally do. We've seen it. but this kind of goes back to my point about how narrative is everything. And one thing that narrative is, it's the relationship between the game and the player and the protagonist, the player and the systems, the story and the mechanics, the protagonist and the mechanics and the systems. And the more that you solidify these relationships so that you have a very cohesive game, the more engaged the player is going to be. And so it doesn't matter what kind of player you are at that point. If you can deliver that, you're going to sell the game to the player. They're going to like the game because they're having a cohesive, enjoyable experience. So I think they're, in a way, there's only so much you can do with the writing, and you have to work on the narrative everywhere else in the game so that a lot of people can enjoy it.
Absolutely. Anne, are you the, or were you about to say something?
Yeah, actually, I was going to say a counter to Mel. I'm actually, I played adventure games for the longest time. I'm from the era of adventure games, like 11th Hour and 7th Guest and all that stuff. So I was like raised on that, basically. I got my parents to get me a computer for university papers, but it was really to play Gabriel Knight.
We've all done that.
Which, you know, once my papers were done, I played all night, basically. So I've always really liked the story. And I used to play RPG like Eye of the Beholder and Menza Branzen and some of the really old, like the little squares that you move forward one at a time, old school stuff. But if there's no story, like Mel was saying, there needs to be gameplay at least. But I think the best merge is when your gameplay and your narrative works well together. That's the best experience.
Exactly.
And Anne, do you play like longer narrative games these days too, or do you prefer Civ?
well, we don't have to keep talking about Civ. It's fine. There are other games in the world, I realize.
I will lean towards RPGs, and now that there are more adventure games back in the market, towards those games. But I actually did want to get the last Sid Meier, so.
Yeah.
Awesome.
Let's see. Tyranny just came out too. I was planning on getting that. That's pretty high on my wish list.
Yeah.
The new Planescape Torment that's going to come out, I'm looking forward to.
I could get like one of those, but more than one would just kill me.
Oh, I used to beat all the RPGs like Baldur's Gate and Icewind Dale. I had time when I was young. Now I've resigned myself to cracking it open and playing some of it and going, that was really fun. And eventually it just gets put on a shelf and I don't finish it. But a lot of the indie stuff too is like, they're shorter games and I really, really enjoy them. I'm actually trying to start Steam now so I can throw a couple of names at you, but
Do it.
There's yeah, it's updating, of course, because that's what Steam does. But there's a couple of games out there that are really fun and that are narrative based, but that don't take too long, which means I could sit down and play them conceivably without, you know, wasting all my, without having to not sleep, because I can't do that anymore. I'm too old to not sleep. I need my sleep now.
Do you think games to be shorter?
For me, it helps. Shorter games are just, I can handle those. I'm hitting my library now. I'll be able to say names soon. Let's see. Rose of Winter is one I just got that I really want to play, and that's like, I think, 2 hours, so that's pretty close on my list. Pillars of Eternity, of course, but got 22 hours on record, but wow, I'm just not going to finish that. I've got Oxenfree that's queued up. I've got the Nelly Kudalot that I backed on Kickstarter. I played Never Alone, and I loved it. And, you know, Stardew Valley, a friend got it for me. Leanne is amazing. She got that for me because I needed the just be able to do this thing that went well and that was relaxing. But I'm going to lose my life to that game. I can't play that.
Oh, I've logged a good 200 hours into Harvest Moon, so I totally am with you there.
I believe you. And, I've got We Happy Few. A lot of the new stuff is really fun, and I've got, like, I really want to play Witcher 3. I really, really want to play it. I'm just scared of losing my life to it.
We finally beat it, like, a month ago, and it was amazing, but after a certain point, we just, like, okay, we have to stop playing side quests. We have to beat this main quest now.
But that's
like,
my 200 problem.
Hours later.
That's my problem. It was the same thing in Skyrim. I was like, main quest, whatever. I'm going to go pick flowers, and I just, you know, head off in the boondocks, and then, you know, 30 hours later, I'm like, oh, right, there's a main quest. I should go do that. Look, there's something else I can do over there.
Do you think we'll ever see, like, the next couple of years, like a AAA studio putting out a high budget 3 hour game, like as their main release, not as DLC, like the Tomb Raider's Gone Home thing they just put out,
or a side project,
or like a side project like Grow Home was, but like Assassin's Creed 3 hour experience.
The problem is they want the player to stay in the game forever.
But they know, they have the research that says no one ever finishes the games they buy.
But the thing is also, that's what DLC are when you look at it certain way. Like, DLC are shorter and, you know, they can append them to the main game.
But you could sell a main game for $60.
Yeah, I know. I think it would be nice to see, you know, AAA production qualities on a shorter scale game, but then the budget thing might hurt that.
How so?
Well, I mean, if they have a huge team working on that, and that then marketing is going to want to sell the game for more than maybe a game that length should be sold.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So it's kind of a serpent eating its tail kind of deal, whereas indie teams or, you know, smaller teams, lower budgets, they get to sell for that for the price that goes with the time, too. Not to say that there isn't quality. Quite to the contrary, there is quality.
Then I would slightly change my idea to not make, like, maybe not shorter, but taking, like, open world games and toning down, like cutting down how big the open world is. Like, let me build me 4 square blocks of a city and really delve into, like, put in the details for that. Like, give me, everyone's got the story for real this time. Like, everyone can follow anybody. They got their whole lives they're doing. Instead of, like, I don't need a whole city. I just need, like, give me a neighborhood.
I think companies are still stuck on open world having to be huge and expansive, and you can go everywhere and do everything.
Because world to do that yet. World.
I know.
World but, is I mean, big.
You know, look at some of the stuff like the Last Nathan Drake, or they're getting 9 to 12 hours now, I think. So some of them are getting shorter than what they used to be, and they work more on the experience and the content.
Yeah.
But I don't think you're ever going to see a small open world. I think they're too stuck on world and big.
World and world.
One could dream. As long as we're talking about open worlds now, I'll just ask this question. What do both of you see as the strengths and weaknesses of the open world genre from, like, a storytelling angle?
Trying to force it to be linear is a bad idea. Mm-hmm. You have to learn to let that go. It's like, I think Skyrim does that. There's a main quest, but, you know, go do all that other shit and you're fine. Sorry, I don't know if I could swear on this show or not.
Yes,
no, you can. We're explicit.
Cool. But, oh, good. But, I think it's being able to figure out how to do your narrative in a nonlinear way is vital.
Yeah.
And I don't see that as a strength or a weakness necessarily. It's just, it's part and parcel of the open world genre.
Has any open world game done that well, though? Because even Skyrim, it's like, it's a very important thing. You're going to save the world, and it has the same problem where, like, well, I need to save the world, but I can go join the Thieves Guild.
I would love to see the metrics for all the open world games we've had lately to see how many people play the main narrative to the end versus just get lost in the world and eventually stop playing. Those would be magical numbers to see, I think.
Yeah, I think Witcher 3 started to go that way. Like,
yeah.
And it's because they focused on having, instead of telling one streamlined story, like they have that, but they also have a bunch of little stories that were really interesting. And so I think that did them a lot of favors.
Yeah, having not played it yet, I'm going to fall down that pit soon enough. Yeah. But I have heard good things about where they're going and what they're doing.
Yeah.
It has the best side quest I've ever played in a game.
Yeah, I mean, it took them a while to get there, but I'm glad they did.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mel, did you say your strengths and weaknesses for you?
I kind of had the same thing, so we could move on.
Okay, that's fine.
So, Anne, on Mass Effect, was there any push and pull for being scientifically accurate? I'm assuming it was like to a point you're scientifically accurate, but then it's you don't have like a science team that's vetoing every decision you make.
I came to the IP as a fan first, so I knew, like, as when I started as a writer, I knew that it's a hard science IP. They don't want to do space magic. You know, they've got their MacGuffins, but the idea is to, and it was proven out as I worked on it, you do your research. Huh. As much as you can, especially for the peripheral stuff. You know, when you're doing main narrative, you want to make your story work. You want to make your story fun and involving, and that's a main rule, right? But you want to couch it in modern day science and, you know, even cutting edge technology, but things that you know are theoretically possible, and then you take it that step further to serve your narrative. It's a very natural way to work for that IP. Like, I've never had any problems with it.
Do you have any secret go-tos for researching that you have?
Don't just
any secret websites that you go back to?
Like, seriously, I've hit so many forums. Like, the science forums are amazing for that. We have some experts. We have people on staff who've been doing that for a long time. We have, you know, all of us are geeks in one way or another, and everyone has the feel that they're really into. And we've had people who'd worked in genetics before. Right now, Joanna Berry, who is still on staff there, is amazing. She loves research, and she just you can fact check stuff with her and work with her to create stuff, and it's great. And you know, Chris Hepler did that before too. It's there's usually one writer or two writers that establish themselves as, we like researching this stuff. Come to us if you need things. And again, part of being a team, right, is that people take on different mantles, and we end up helping each other out a lot.
Yeah, and Mel, it's kind of the same question. Was there a push and pull on Assassin's Creed between being historically accurate and what you wanted to pull off storytelling-wise?
Yeah. I mean, for me, historical fiction, I mean, we also have, like, a tiny bit of, like, science fiction, but historical fiction is my jam. I'm a huge history nerd, and I think I learned that a little bit too late in university to actually take history as, like, a thing. But I did English Lit, so it makes for a good combo for historical fiction. but so being a writer, I've always loved boundaries and, like, playing with boundaries. And I think historical fiction gives you a lot of boundaries to deal with, because there's all these characters that, like, especially in, like, the AC games, that have things that they did in life, and you kind of have to put yourself in their mindset and figure out what personality went along with that if you don't know, or trying to emulate what personality that did survive. So there are those boundaries that you have to deal with, like on Syndicate. It was like, it's a little bit daunting, but I was like really, really excited that we were going to have a game with Charles Dickens, because I was like, oh man, this guy's messed and I love him. And just trying to like figure out how he sounds and what he would say. I ended up listening to a lot of his audiobooks of his books. And I basically used inspiration from the narrator like the person who was narrating the novel to kind of be my kind of guide of like what Charles Dickens would sound like in real life. So I kind of emulated that. But yeah, so there's those boundaries you have to keep in mind. And then there's also like, if you write so much for the historical stuff and then you have to kind of fill the voids that the like characters don't provide for you. So going back to Syndicate again, we had characters that we made, like fictional characters that we made that could kind of show other historical aspects that we hadn't hit yet through the historical characters that we did have. So we have a lot of writers, like we had Charles Dickens, we had like Karl Marx, which was crazy. I like don't envy the person that wrote that, because imagine trying to get into that mindset. Amazing. But then we had characters that were like, oh, you have Ned. We needed basically like a train and transportation, like Baron. And we had Roth, who was like a head gangster. Like you want to take parts of history that you may not have like an actual character you can associate them with, and try to make them fit in your game so that you can represent as much as possible. But at the end of the day, you're also making a game, and you have to make the best choice for your audience, or the audience that will receive it. So sometimes you have to let some of it go, and sometimes you want to let some of it go.
During development, did you start off with like a research phase, then move into writing, or did you immediately start writing to get into production, then were just researching the entire time?
It starts with a lot of research, because you have to know what you're writing about before you write it, I think. It really shows if you're not simultaneously, like even if you did start writing right away, you have to research simultaneously, because it really shows if you don't know your shit.
Yeah.
A lot of the time you can't fake historical fiction, because it's everywhere, like on the internet, right? And people will nail you for it.
And it's the same thing too. If you're working on hard science as an AP, someone will call it out. Like, you know, in that sense, you know, if you're doing stuff like Star Wars and space magic or stuff like that, it's a little bit easier on you.
How much does that affect your writing? Like people calling you out?
Well, ideally, if you've done your work right, you won't get called out. That's what you aim for.
Yeah.
And now I'm the one that's calling writers out, so.
I mean, you know, like on any project I've been on at any given time, you'll usually have someone on the team also sometimes come up to you and say, hey, this, are you sure? And if you're lucky enough to work with editors, they're amazing. I cannot tell you how much I love editors.
Sounds great. Love to work with one.
Oh, it will change your life. I mean, you know, it's really helpful, not just like to help polish your writing, but also to give that final polish, but because editors have their eyes on the entire game. And when you're working with sprawling open world games or RPGs, just anything that's really, you know, requires several writers to do, I'm talking on the upward close to 10, because editors have their eyes on everything, they can go, so-and-so's done this, or so-and-so's done that, or, you know, someone explained the science this way, and someone explained it that way, which one do we want to use for everyone? And that's really good. And then sometimes you just slip up and you're more careful next time.
Yeah. And then for us, we also have a historian, like on AC Games, we'll have a historian work with us too, so we can ask them questions. And then on Syndicate, we forwarded a lot of all of the scripts, not a lot, all of the scripts to the historian to fact check. I mean, and sometimes you have to say, well, we have to do this anyway, like, sorry, history, but but on other times you're like, yep, I can make a change. And sometimes it's just like a single word that you can't use because it wasn't out at that point. Wasn't out, like it wasn't released. No, I mean, it wasn't. It
wasn't in use.
Being, yes.
And Mel, you were talking about boundaries before. Like for both of you who come onto franchises after they started, does it feel easier to work on them when you already have things settled? Like, here's what this series is about. This is our central gameplay loop, etc. Or is it harder?
I'm going to take this one first. That's okay. I find it infinitely easier. Like any writer will tell you, don't just throw us don't just throw at us, write whatever you want. It's the worst thing you can say to a writer. Write this. Here's a framework. Write within this framework. It's so reassuring.
They think they want that, but yeah. They don't.
Yeah, no. It's much better to have things that are established because it's a starting point. You know, it doesn't stop you from doing anything. It just gives you that you can go, oh, I know where to go now because I've got this thing here and I build on that. That's what writers do. So no, it's much easier to walk into a franchise when it's already been established and there's been work done for sure.
And I don't think it limits you because at the end of the day, you identify kind of what the base of the game is, like whether you're making like a top-down, like, city game in different locations, or, like...
Like Civ.
Like Civ. Or or SimCity. Hey. Or you're, like, making a murder simulation in different time periods. Like, you have to identify, like, what those things are, and then you can morph it to what you want it to be.
Yeah.
And, like, I think, too, on things... On a game like AC... there are pillars that kind of hold up the game. So once you identify those, you just need to be aware of what the game is like comprised of. And then you say like, okay, here are the ingredients. Now make a cool drink, make a cool cocktail, that kind of thing.
Yeah. I mean, a thing that comes up very often when I'm at cons and stuff is what do I think about fan fiction? And I mean, you got to admit, you walk into a franchise, it's a bit like being paid to write fan fiction. Kind of what it is at the end of the day. And you know, fan fiction is a great way to learn how to work on a franchise. You know, in the sense that you got to follow those rules, though. But most franchises just go, here are the basic rules, go. And that's great.
Yeah, and I don't know, I talk to writers about that, too. I think there's, like, a stigma about fan fiction where there doesn't necessarily have to be. And so when I'm... helping writers or like mentoring writers through Pixels in Montreal, and they ask, can I submit fan fiction? I'm like some people have different approaches, but at the end of the day, that's kind of what we're doing.
Well, I mean, it's like when I was working on Naruto, golly gee, I guess you can submit fan fiction of Naruto because that makes sense for the game we're making, right?
Yeah, so. Exactly.
Also, like, good writing is good writing. Mm-hmm. You can tell if it's, it doesn't matter if it's fan fiction or not.
Yeah, and like, I gotta say, there's some amazing fan fiction out there.
Sure. Like, do not slight fan fiction. It can be great.
And I mean, also, seriously, when you're stumped writing one thing, you can just go, hey, I'm just gonna write 100 words of on this thing of fan fiction because it's easy to get back into, and that gets you back into the groove of writing, and then you switch back to your original content as you need to.
Yeah.
It's a basic writing exercise I've got.
Moving back a little bit, who/what would you say are your biggest influences in your work?
I consume media on a daily basis. I watch TV, I watch movies, I read books, and all of that just comes together to influence at this point. I've been doing that for a while now, and it's just always keeping your mind open and always looking to see what other people are doing, and then what do you feel like doing?
Is there anything you go back to, like, every, like, couple of years? Like, is there a book you reread every now and then or something you rewatch?
I rewatch X-Files on a regular basis. Every 2-3 years, I just mainline the whole series again. I would have to say Star Trek. Star Trek is the one thing that has been prevalent in my whole life. In Star Wars, too, but it's Star Trek was, I was raised on it, basically. And I think that shaped a lot of my... Which is why when Mel was talking about Hope earlier, I was like, hell yeah, Hope! Because, you know, that's a thing in humor in the original series. It's discounted a lot, but there was a lot of humor in the original series. Like, the movie, The Voyage Home, is a great example of that. So, yeah. Now that I'm, like, narrowing that down, I would have to say Star Trek is definitely a thing. And X-Files is my modern-day thing.
Mel, your influences?
Cartoons are a huge influence to me. I love cartoons so much because I think that they can explore an element of truth that some live action shows cannot. And I've thought a lot about it, and sometimes like it's hard to put your finger on like how they do it, but I think by making things a cartoon or an animation, you're kind of you're having that moment of like disbelief because you're living in a cartoon instead of real life. So you like extend that disbelief. And then with that range that they've given themselves, they can explore a level of truth that other kinds of TV shows or movies or mediums can't. And I've always loved cartoons for that. I've always identified more with cartoon characters than like any other character ever. And it's something that I always go back to because they always make me feel so good too. Anytime I'm feeling down or I need inspiration or, you know, I just like kind of need to not use my brain to think about work, or some bad things that are happening in the world. I always go back to them. And so there's a huge passion there. And I also,
which cartoons?
Oh man, there's been some really good ones in the past years. Like Steven Universe is amazing.
Yes, I was gonna say that one.
Yeah, so good. Like it quickly climbed to the top for me. Adventure Time. I was in love with Adventure Time when I first started watching it. It was like a comfort at any point in my life. I loved Lemon Grab so much. Ed Rootbeer guy. I don't know those characters. Man, they speak to me. I loved Gravity Falls, and I still quote it. Man, today I was sitting in a meeting, and I was like, "Girl, why are you acting so cray cray?" Which is a line from that. Nobody ever knows what I'm talking about, by the way. Over the Garden.
Did that go over well in the meeting?
Yes, because they've been with me now long enough to know, like, okay, Mel's just going to say weird things at different times, and we get it.
That crazy Mel acting up again.
It's true. I mean, depends on the day, but sometimes I'll just, like, sing. Over the Garden Wall was magnificent. The Marvelous Misadventures, or The Marvelous Misadventures of Flapjack. Oh, man, there's just, like, Rick and Morty, BoJack Horseman. There's so many good ones out there. I could go on forever, so I won't. And then my other big thing is I love comics, too, that, to me. That's always a big thing. But also, weird thing, I have chronic fatigue. I've had it since I was in grade 11. And so a lot of the times, if I sit in bed, I fall asleep. So reading books for me has become like an actual challenge of like staying awake and being able to consume information, like reading novels. So I listen to audiobooks a lot. And what I've tried to do recently was alternate books. I'm no longer in school, and I always feel like I need to educate myself anyway, because I always want to be a better person. And I want to be a better person for other people. Like, I'm making a product that is mass consumed, and I want that product to be inviting for lots of people. And so what I've been trying to do is kind of educate myself by alternating books. So I'll read fluff, or I'll read historical fiction, and then like the next book I'll read will be something to kind of educate myself on different points of view. One of my go-to people who I like dearly, dearly love, when I read her, I'm like, thank God you exist. Like, you've helped make the world a better place, is Audre Lorde. Like, absolutely, completely in love with Audre Lorde. And I just read Sister Outsider, and I was like, oh, this was the perfect, I was scared. It was weird. I was scared to approach her again. I've read, a couple things of hers. I was scared to approach her again because I was like, and this sounds awful, but I was like, am I just going to be really sad? But she has this magic about her that is explaining her rationale, like explaining her thought in a way that is really, really welcoming to people and really educational. And it's still completely like truth filled and hard facts. But she's so good at kind of like being like, this is the state of the world, and this is where the world needs to be. And this is how I think people can help. And I've always loved that about her.
I actually just got her book, and it's on my pile of books waiting to be read.
I'm excited for you.
we'll put it in the show notes.
Just cry. It's so good.
I have no segue for this, and it's a big question, but for both of you. In a lot of today's games, players are able to do so many different things. So how do you craft a satisfying narrative that can come close to acknowledging all those possibilities without diluting the story you want to tell?
If you're going to do branching choices, part of it is because you can't offer too much, or else you're going to split into an infinity of choices, and then your game's going to be so bloated and people are just going to see one small part of it, and you'll have done all that work that no one will ever see, right? Part of it is ensuring that you're giving really good choices within the realm of the ones you can budget and do. And part of it is just, I hate to put it this way, but it's faking it. It's giving the fantasy of, giving the players the impression that they're getting all these possibilities while still managing to herd them back to the story.
Secret. On the flip side of that, there is this like need to stop handholding the player. There are games that will handhold the whole time and they don't give you enough freedom because they really want to streamline everything mm-hmm. that you do, even though they're like, no, we're trying to make this open world, but they don't let the player play like it's an open world. And it's interesting because gameplay is rarely like super, super innovative in games. And gameplay repeats itself a lot. And so you need narrative in games to kind of pull the players in different directions and have them experience different things. And, but you need that in a very open sense so that, you're not just dictating what the player does all the time.
Yeah. It's the difference between if you're going to give choices that will be reflected later, then you've got to herd to a certain level or you just got to give content that won't affect those choices necessarily, or affect it in just a mathematical way, versus if you've got it, like going back to Skyrim, you've got that main linear narrative, or Witcher, you've got that main story, but you've got the confidence to say, but go do whatever you want. Come back to it whenever you're ready. Mm-hmm. And there are projects and there are games that are comfortable doing that. And there are some that are still learning how to do it. And there's some that just don't want to do it. And I mean, these are all fine. I mean, you get the project, you get the game that you get working that way.
This reminds me of like little narrative dissonance. And is that like something that you worry about, or is there like a certain amount of dissonance that you're okay with, or do you generally try to fight against that as much as possible?
I just don't do a, you have to do this thing in this set time and it's super urgent, and then expect players to wander off for 3 hours and not come back and not feel that dissonance. There are things you just got to avoid doing if you want to support that.
I agree.
Good answer. I should have asked this before when we were talking about side content, but is there any concern from both of you about side content overshadowing the main narrative of a game?
I'll take this one because this was the question that kind of caught me. Was I kind of feel like that's actually what I would like to strive for, actually, is to have like a blurred line in between what is main narrative, I said in scare quotes, and what is side content. I think it's actually really neat sometimes, and I know that there are boundaries to this as well, like what we were just talking about with giving the player like too much freedom. But one thing that I think is really interesting and something that I strive for would be for players to kind of not really know what the main path is and what the side content is, and kind of let them get lost a little bit in that world.
Did you have anything you wanted to add, Anne?
Coming at it purely from the writer perspective, like the people crafting this stuff, I found that most of the time there are more eyes on the crit path, if you will, and the linear narrative, mm-hmm. and less so on the side content. And the result of that is sometimes that, you know, sometimes side content is generic, but sometimes there'll be this really, really rich little story that no one expected. And then when you talk with people about a game, they're like, did you play this quest? It was amazing. And they're not talking to you about the main narrative. They're talking about this little quest they found out, you know, in the boondocks, and that everyone loves because it's got so much character, because there were less people looking at it and there was more freedom to write stuff in it as a result.
And I think it's important for like developers to realize that whatever they're working on isn't less significant than something else. And I think like games have to evolve to get to that point. Like, I'm not saying that we're there yet, But that if they're working on something that is deemed side content, that isn't necessarily, it isn't lesser than what is the main narrative. I mean, of course, budget dictates like where you can put enhancements, but I think it's important for developers to know that what they're owning is good work, and it's not less important than something else.
I mean, if you want people to explore your open world, you got to put the good stuff out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. This is a more general question, not related to anything, but what have been the easiest and most challenging characters for both of you to write?
The easiest, the most fun character? Like, it depends. Depends how you mean challenging. You mean challenging like a challenge but fun to do, or challenging like a complete slog to do? I need clarification here. All right.
They don't know how to get through it.
Oh, I knew how to write him. I just hated the character. Sasuke for Naruto. I was just like, emo child, let me strangle him and focus on the other characters. Oh my god,
like
I couldn't stand him.
The world, so.
How'd you get through that then?
It was because we were basically recounting the events from the early sets of episodes. I at least had a template to do, and I would just, you know, I would write all my stuff, and then I would go, okay, did I shortchange him? And then I would go back and check on that to make sure that I hadn't been too rough with the character. But, oh, the team heard me moan and groan about him so much. And I have to say that the character that I've enjoyed the most writing, I can't talk about, but would be the squadmate that I wrote for Mass Effect Andromeda. I'm incredibly proud of the writing and what I got to put in there, and I can't wait until people see that.
Was that also the one that came easiest to you?
Yes.
Okay.
And I still can't say more.
Yeah, that's fine. And Belle?
I find a really big challenge is trying to break into a historical character. I'm just going to go off of characters from Syndicate, since it was the most recent. And it was the most like heavily invested I've ever been in a game. And so trying to like figure out, like, you have certain pieces of information about who this person was, but you have no idea what they sounded like or what their personality was like, except like maybe one description from somebody else who is probably super biased. And so on Syndicate, I had a really hard time trying to figure out who Sergeant Averline was, the cop that was always in disguise. Because I wrote a couple scenes for him like early in the process, because he was kind of one of the characters that really stuck. But it was really hard because I couldn't hear him. And so when you're writing, you're like, who is this person? Like, as you're doing it, obviously isn't a good vibe to have. Whereas sometimes you really can nail those characters. Like, I'll go back to Charles Dickens. He like floated onto the page, and he also floated on the mocap floor. But he was like I loved Dickens's stories, and so it was really easy for me to write him, and he just came out onto the page really naturally. Another character that I had the most fun writing, who was also quite easy from that game, was Roth, the villain from Sequence 8. He was really, really chaotic, and I'd always wanted to write my own super villain, basically, because I love the challenge of the villain. I think villains are super, super interesting to write, because they can justify what they do as not so bad, and I think it's really interesting to try and get into that headspace and like, how do you rationalize something like that, and how does that persona end up coming out? And so I really, really loved writing Roth for those reasons, and to me, it was also really easy to picture what he was doing and how he was saying everything. And it was easy for me to convey that to the actors later without having to like force feed them information. He was one of the ones I had the most fun with.
Just to pick off what Mel was saying too, sometimes you're lucky enough to actually know who your voice actor is before you start writing, or very early on in the writing. And that is such a help in finding the character's voice.
When you're assigned a character, what sort of work do you do for yourself to help find that character's voice? Like, do you make a little miniature bio of the character? or what else do you do?
At Bioware, that's what we did. And before that, I have mostly had characters who came from IPs or licenses that were already established. But I have found that biography is super useful, but also writing down what is the one thing that character will surprise you with. Like, what is the one thing they won't budge on? And having that line in the sand where you're writing, you go, well, yes, you know, they would bend for this, or no, this is the point where they, like, surprise the player, or they won't do this thing, is very useful.
Yeah. Mel?
Yeah, for us, we have the historical references, and of course, depending on what time period you're in, kind of dictates how much information you have about somebody. But yeah, so we write bios, and sometimes, like, they kind of merge together, but like character arcs, so we know where that character is going, and try to insert details, kind of like what Anne was saying, like, what's the hard line that they won't cross? What is their really strange quirk that always seems to come up? For writing characters in games, a lot of the times there's lots of characters, and they all kind of, you don't want them to fade away into nothingness. You need to make them interesting. And this is actually, I'm just going to keep talking about him. Something I learned from Charles, my man, Charles Dickens, was he writes a billion characters, right? And you don't see them unless you're watching a televised version of something that he wrote. But he has so many characters, in the way that he helps you remember which characters are which is they always have like they have a tagline, or they have like a motto that they repeat over and over. So the guy that's like, decorum, you're like, oh yeah, that's like the ballet dancer's dad. Which that's actually really true. I've read too much of them. There's like a woman who's always talking about how like the world is doomed, and they're like, oh yeah, that's that lady with all the crazy birds. And so you always know who he's referring to because they kind of always have that tagline that comes up. And I think that's really like a useful thing to apply to games where there's like tons and tons and tons of characters that may come back.
Yeah.
There's one thing I want to backtrack to also. Sometimes you feed a bio to the character artists and the concept artists, but sometimes the concept artists feed you art first. And that's always an interesting relationship, because when you get the art, you can go, oh, well, I'll build off that. And when you don't, and then you're the ones feeding the other way, you're peppered with 1,000 questions. But it's always fun, because then it's like, oh, they're interested in the bio I wrote. Let me tell you more. And then sometimes, you know, it'll be exactly what you imagine. And sometimes you're like, I never would have thought. But it's great.
Yeah.
When you get art first, does that totally change the way you write?
It inspires. I wouldn't say it changes how I write, but it definitely changes how my preliminary approach to the character, because I've got a person in front of me. And so I'm like, well, why would they wear this thing that, you know, the character artist put on them, or the concept artist thought would be cool, you know? And sometimes I'll ask the concept artist, why did you give them a red scarf? And they're like, color chart, man. Or, you know, I don't know. Or they have this whole story already in their mind. And, you know, it's a fun collaboration.
Yeah.
Like, again, it's not just the writer. It's a team effort.
And like Anne said before, if you get a chance, like, it doesn't usually happen because it's later in the process, but if you get a chance to have worked with an actor that you're writing for, they bring so much to that character. Writing, it stops at a point before an actor takes the character and makes it their own. And if you're lucky enough to be writing at the same time that you're mocapping something else in it, and it takes the same character, sometimes you can learn a lot from watching those mocap sessions or listening to those recording sessions and then applying it to your script.
And you mentioned before about learning the voice actor before you start writing. If you don't know the voice actors' work, then are you just going and researching the roles they've done before to hear their voice?
I'll listen to their demo reel. Just the demo reel will give you like a variety of characters, so you won't get locked down on a thing, but it gives you an idea of their range too. So sometimes it's like you're writing stuff and you're like, oh, I hope the voice actor can carry it off. And sometimes you're like, oh, I know this voice actress can totally do this thing. Let's go there, that you would just never do before. But now you know you've got someone who can totally bring it off and make it sound great.
Yeah. Okay. New question. With the many departments you have to go work with and go between, what's been the most useful thing that both of you have gleaned from it that's helped your storytelling?
I think I already touched on this before, but it's communication. Mm-hmm. And it really does help your story. Like, it sounds weird to be like, yeah, talking to other people helps you write better, but it does, because everything you write implicates some other team, some other department, and everything they do, it touches on your stuff. So the better you can communicate, the better your story's going to be. And the better you know how to sell your idea, the easier it is for you to get it into the game.
That's exactly what I was going to say too. Communication and collaboration.
We are one.
But seriously though, I mean, we're making characters who are in a game who have abilities that game design and gameplay are going to create for you. If you don't talk with them in order to build a skill set that makes sense for your character, you're going to end up with a character that you created as a thief who's a tank for whatever reason, right?
Yeah.
So, like, and also just the more you communicate and work with each other, the more you can integrate the subtle things that give a lot of character and a lot of depth to what you bring to the screen in terms of narrative. And like Mel was saying earlier, like we were talking about earlier, the more you work with level design, you know, if your character tends to do a certain thing, like hop over gates or whatever, or jump in water puddles, then, you know, level designer's going to integrate that. If you talk about that with your concept artists, well, maybe they're going to draw the bottom of their pants is always wet. You know, it's like, these are all things that if you work as an island, you don't get all of those additional details. And at the end of the day, they're not details. They're part of what makes it a whole. And it's super important.
Could this be easily done just by having like a studio-wide policy of, hey, every week, all these people need to be with these people, and then these people need to meet with these people? Or would it have to be something that's more organic and it could only happen that way?
Studio policies for syncing up never survive. Never survive the fires of production. Oh, God. It really, and even then, like, people say, oh, just email or message. And I'm like, no. Get up and go talk
yes.
to the person. Get up and stand at their desk. And if they're super busy, yes, let them finish their work or just poke them first to check. But talking face to face with someone is the best way to communicate on a project. Like, I've regularly gone up a floor or down a floor at Ubisoft, and there are floors at Ubisoft,
yep.
just to make sure of a thing, because the human connection when you're working is super important.
And
which brings us full circle to what Mel was saying about going to university.
Yes. I don't remember what I was going to say.
Communication, important.
Communication is important. One of the things that I do a lot now is say, when I'm reviewing scripts, is like, make sure you talk to this person so we can sell this moment. Like, make sure you're talking to this person, make sure you're checking with this person. Did you check with this person? And really trying to, sometimes I think writers need a little bit of like, cattle prodding to go speak to other people. But once you realize that there's a person on the other side of that Skype chat, I think it's a lot easier to get your point across. And it's a lot easier to sort out any conflict that you may have, because it's so easy to misinterpret text and emails, as we all know.
Tone is so hard. Tone is so hard by text.
I think that's a good way to end this, too.
Tone is hard in text.
Talk
and communication
to people.
Is good.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's the basics of making games is being able to communicate with not just people in your department, but in any department.
I mean, it's probably like the basis of a functioning society is communication. If we're all open to more communication, this world would probably be a bit of a better place.
That's your lesson, listeners. Talk to your other team members.
So, where can people find you two on the internet?
I'm on Twitter as Melkart the Third, or Melkarty with three I's. I have my own website, melmacubri.com, You can find the spelling in the description of this podcast.
yes.
I'm on Instagram as Mel McCoubry, so you can find me there.
And what about you?
You can find me on Twitter. It's just my full name, Anne LeMay, Anne without an E, unlike Anne of Green Gables.
Oh, so cute.
And I'm on, you can find my Instagram from my Twitter, because I forget what the name is right now. I've got two variables I go with, and I'm not using my actual name. I'm like, oh crap, which one did I use for that? But yeah, Twitter's your best bet to reach me.
Awesome. Would you like to boost your book?
Oh my gosh. You do that to me, and I forget the name. The game narrative toolbox. I was missing game. I was like, the narrative toolbox. I'm missing something. Yes, I was very fortunate to get to collaborate on the game narrative toolbox. You can find it on Amazon.
And in the show notes for this podcast.
But thank you, T, for coming on today and talking to us.
Thank you for having us.
Yeah, thank you for inviting us.